From WAMC in Albany, this is the Legislative Gazette, a weekly magazine about New York State government and politics. Your host is David Gustina, with political commentary by Dr. Alan Shartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
Coming up this week, Governor Cuomo puts up money for early voting.
Our political observer, Alan Shartok, shares his thoughts on the latest Republican candidate to enter the race for governor.
And the New York Farm Bureau releases its national priorities for 2018. Those stories and more on the Legislative Gazette.
Governor Andrew Cuomo is putting $7 million into his 30-day budget amendments to fund poll sites for early voting in New York by the 2020 presidential race. The Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt reports.
The funds would be used to set up at least one polling site in every county 12 days before Election Day, so that voters can have several weekdays and two full weekends before elections to cast their ballot early. Cuomo's budget director, Robert Mojica, made the announcement.
So we're going to provide sufficient funding to support early voting. The budget included a provision to allow for early voting. We'll make sure the funding is there for local governments to be able to pay for those additional costs.
The measure gives counties flexibility on choosing the polling site and the specific hours that it would be open. Counties can even use their own Board of Elections offices as the location if they choose. But it requires that there be one early polling site for every 50,000 voters and up to seven early polling sites in each of the heavily populated boroughs of New York City. The move was applauded by government reform advocates, including Jennifer Wilson of the League of Women Voters. She says it's a step toward improving New York's abysmal voter turnout.
And we're really excited because this is the first time that there's ever been money tied to early voting in the state budget.
She says the $7 million, though, is really seed money to get things started in time for the 2020 presidential elections, and that more money is needed to actually create and staff the polling sites. Under Cuomo's plan, the early voting would begin in the off-year elections of 2019, where the races are local and turnout is lower, in order to work out any kinks in the new system.
We'll need this money again next year. So we'll need this money this year, we'll need it next year, and we'll continue to need this money until we really work out all the bugs, hopefully consolidate primaries and save some money, maybe have vote by mail as well, and be able to have some cost savings result from all of this.
There are some potential drawbacks to early voting, such as if something negative breaks about a candidate late in the race that might make voters change their minds.
We've seen that recently with a candidate attacking a press person, and people were like, oh, I want to change my vote. But it's a risk that you take. And if you voted by absentee, you could essentially be doing that too, where if you voted by absentee and you voted for this candidate and they changed, then you decided you didn't want to vote for them anymore. It's a risk that you have to take.
The legislature still has to approve the measure to actually permit the early voting. The state assembly, run by Democrats, approved a similar early voting provision in 2017, but the measure has stalled in the state Senate, where Republicans rule the chamber. Democrats in the Senate backed the idea and have introduced a bill, but so far there is no GOP co-sponsor. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt.
Joining us now, Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Shartok. Alan, a candidate for governor. We know that Republican John DeFrancisco from Syracuse is in the race. The now new, it appears, candidate is Republican Joseph Holland, who is the co-chair of former Governor George Pataki's winning campaign in 1994.
Well, look, DeFrancisco himself thinks that this is a possible win against Cuomo, even with this $30 million and this being a Democratic year, if there ever was going to be one, especially in New York State. And he cites Pataki, but that was 1994, and that was a Republican year. It was Mario's fourth try to be governor of New York. And so it was a very different time. On the other hand, I think a lot of the Republicans were counting on the fact that this trial was going to blow the top off of the administration of a guy who said, I'm going to come to Albany and clean everything up. He tried to do that as attorney general. He got some high marks for doing that. His numbers are going down now. He's still above 50%, and above 50% is a winning hand in this poker of politics. On the other hand, the trajectory is going down, and there are going to be a whole bunch of other trials related to all of this. So, if you follow the logic, there could be some danger for Cuomo here, because after all, if these guys around him, whether they're found guilty or not, were pulling some stunts that were massively unattractive to people, people say, well, who's watching the store, right? They may blame Cuomo, and to some degree, he will deserve some of that blame because his top guys were misbehaving, or at least allegedly misbehaving.
Will there be any effect from the head of the state Republican Party, Ed Cox, who has filed a formal complaint with the state's Public Ethics Commission, Alan, alleging that Governor Andrew Cuomo and his top aide, Joe Percoco, now on trial for bribery in Manhattan, broke the state's public officers law?
Well, let me put it this way. We do know now that Percoco was in a building where he was theoretically on leave to run the campaign. Hey, this goes on. It's rife through state government. There are formal advisors, informal, on the payroll, off the payroll. Cox is exactly right to do it. But he better watch out. And I think the guy is a very smart man, and I like him. But he better watch out because, believe me, the Republicans do it too.
Well, in addition to the claim by Ed Cox, let's talk about the trial itself. You spoke with the Albany Bureau Chief of the New York Times, Jesse McKinley, this week about the sort of circus, I guess, that's going on with Todd Howe this week having to trade prison garb for a suit.
Well, it's really kind of funny. The prosecutors who are trying to prosecute Percoco and a whole bunch of other people have a star witness, and that star witness, of course, is Todd Howe. Now, Todd Howe turns out to be a liar, and at least an alleged liar. We should be careful here. And because he broke his agreement with the prosecutors not to do anything illegal while he was being their star witness for months now, and it turns out that he did, so they arrested him, their own witness. And he had been out, of course, on bail because he had already pled guilty to a whole bunch of crimes. So now the prosecutors arrest him and put him in an orange jumpsuit in jail while he's in the middle of his testimony. But then, in one of the most remarkable things we've ever seen, they go back to the judge and say, Judge, it would be prejudicial for him to come in the orange jumpsuit or whatever he'd have to wear. We want him in a suit. And she said, okay, he can wear a suit. In the meantime, the defenders of Percoco and others, the first questions they ask him, says McKinley, is, you know, have you ever committed a felony? And there you go. When asked, was he in trouble? He said he thought he was in trouble. That's the understatement of the year. Look, there's a very good chance that people will get off as a result of the fact that the star witness is anything but credible.
Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Shartok. Listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Democratic Congressman Sean Patrick Maloney was in Orange County to announce legislation to combat online opioid sales. He spoke at the Middletown Police Department alongside a woman whose son died from an overdose 2 years ago. The Legislative Gazette's Allison Dunn was there.
After six people died of drug overdoses in Orange County over the past 2 weeks, Congressman Maloney, whose 18th district includes all of Orange, is joining County District Attorney David Hoover, law enforcement officials, and a mother whose son overdosed on heroin to announce new legislation to combat internet drug sales. The mother is Westchester resident Stephanie Keegan, whom Senate Minority Leader Charles Schumer brought as his guest to President Trump's State of the Union address January 30th to highlight the opioid epidemic. Schumer has been calling on Congress to invest in more opioid treatment and prevention programs. He notes that in fiscal year 2017, $485 million in opioid crisis grants were awarded to states across the country. Of this, New York received $25 million. Schumer, Maloney, and other lawmakers say more needs to be done. In January, on a conference call with reporters, New York Schumer cited the Center for Disease Control and Prevention's annual surveillance report of drug-related risks and outcomes, which shows life expectancy in the U.S. falling slightly for the second year in a row in 2016.
Imagine in 2018, life expectancy in America, these United States of America, this great country, is getting lower. It's not supposed to be, and it doesn't have to be. That the most developed and wealthy country in the world has this. What's one of the biggest reasons? Probably the biggest? Drug overdose deaths. That's right.
Maloney says the internet has increasingly become used for the sale of synthetic drugs like fentanyl and other opioids. He says they can be sold in small packaging, and an individual could acquire enough fentanyl in a standard envelope to get 50,000 people high. Only a few flakes of the drug can be fatal. Maloney says that although one site for this online drug market has been shut down, newer sites have popped up and are projected to sell higher volumes. He says combating online sales has become a bipartisan priority for lawmakers. Meanwhile, Sue Kruzek wrote a Valentine's Day letter to President Trump, reading part of it on Fox & Friends. Trump tweeted this morning after the Connecticut resident appeared on the show, saying, "Thank you to Sue Kruzek, who lost her wonderful and talented son Nick to the opioid scourge, for your kind words on Fox and Friends. We are fighting this terrible epidemic hard. Nick will not have died in vain," end quote. Trump is expected to release his budget proposal today with a $13 billion increase over 2 years for opioid prevention, treatment, and long-term recovery.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Allison Dunn.
New York's Lieutenant Governor Kathy Hochul recently stopped in Saratoga Springs to speak to educators and students about the importance of science, technology, engineering, and math, or STEM learning. The Legislative Gazette's Lucas Willard has more.
Thursday's event in Saratoga Springs is one of three across the state called Workforce 2025. Educators and industry leaders working together to address the middle-level skills gap and prepare New York's workforce of the future. Lieutenant Governor Kathy Hochul spoke to the crowd about the state's work to promote STEM education.
We need to convince people that you don't have to be afraid of technology, that this is an opportunity for you no matter what field you choose, because that is the future.
She made mention of New York's Excelsior Scholarship Program, which offers free in-state tuition for qualifying students. According to Hochul, 65% of children in middle school today will end up in jobs that do not even exist yet.
We need to be able to offer employers a highly educated, skilled workforce, and so many of the jobs of tomorrow come down to having skills in coding and engineering and technology, and we want to just find ways to stimulate an excitement so young people will pursue this, particularly young women.
Hochul took a photo and briefly spoke to students who came down from Beekmantown in Clinton County.
How was the presenting? Go well?
Yeah.
Have you been?
Beekmantown Middle School principal Amy Campbell traveled with her students to share some of the unique approaches her school takes regarding STEM.
So this convening is about workforce development for 2025 or just into the future, and we are a project-based learning school in the middle school, so we were invited to come and talk about our different way we approach our instructional design in the middle school.
Now a 10th grader, David Gagnon, remembered one of his favorite assignments while in middle school.
One that stands out to me in my mind was Build a Better Beekmantown, where we were given a piece of property and we had to change it into something that we wanted to create. My group created a diner, and then we had to create a 3D model and actually make that happen and, you know, figure out all the finances that were required with it and all the information required to do it.
Fellow sophomore Shania Rose was glad to see the Lieutenant Governor mention writing as an essential skill to develop in addition to technical skills.
Also her touch on young women joining like careers that are pretty much predominantly male and stuff like that, because I've thought about going into careers that are predominantly male, just to kind of make my mark.
Governor Andrew Cuomo's budget plan includes a series of proposals focused on young women, including closing the gender gap in STEM and providing mentoring and other leadership opportunities.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Lucas Willard.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. The New York Farm Bureau has released its national agricultural priorities for 2018. The Farm Bill is key, along with trade and regulatory reform, as the Legislative Gazette's Pat Bradley reports.
The State Farm Bureau's priorities emphasize the need for better safety nets, especially for dairy farmers, and reforming immigration and regulatory policies. New York Farm Bureau President David Fisher and other members of the state organization were in the nation's capital last week to discuss what they want to see in the Farm Bill to meet agriculture's needs.
This year, the Farm Bill is up, and the Farm Bureau will be engaged with our federal representatives to assure that our members' priorities are reflected in the final legislation. Ultimately, the Farm Bill is a food security bill, making sure that there's sound farm policy in this country for farmers to be able to grow food, as well as providing access to food for those who can least afford to buy it in some situations.
Fisher believes four priority items must be included in the bill to help New York farmers.
Some of the main points include improving the safety net for dairy farmers. The margin protection program was not successful, and so we're looking to include some options for milk protection pricing for farmers. We're also looking for a farm bill that better reflects the diversity of crops that we have in New York. We're very supportive of making the whole farm revenue protection program more workable for these farms. A couple other priorities in the farm bill include maintaining cost-sharing conservation programs. New York Farm Bureau also opposes splitting off the nutrition portion of the farm bill from agriculture.
New York Farm Bureau Associate Director of National Affairs Lauren Williams noted several regulatory issues the organization has been concerned about, including opposing proposed changes to the Clean Water Act.
The proposed changes, we believe, really broadens the jurisdictions of waters of the U.S. and expands it from navigable waters to include now dry land. We're really supportive of EPA's efforts to rescind the current rule and rewrite it in a way that addresses Congress's intent to protect our nation's water supply. And the Supreme Court recently threw the case back to the district court to sort out, and, you know, this case is likely to be tied up in the courts for a while, but we would still like for EPA to move forward with the process to rescind the rule and work on an appropriate alternative.
Immigration reform and trade remain primary concerns for the industry. David Fisher says a manageable guest worker program is crucial when farmers cannot find local employees.
This involves having an improved guest worker visa program that addresses both seasonal and year-round needs of our farmers. We have to have a system in place that will allow farms in this country to grow the food we need to feed ourselves. New York Farm Bureau will work with President Trump's administration and our representatives in Congress to find a workable solution that strikes an important balance between strong enforcement and a strong guest visa program.
Williams notes the ongoing NAFTA negotiations between the U.S., Canada, and Mexico also concern the ag sector.
U.S. agricultural exports to Canada and Mexico have increased from $8.9 billion to over $38 billion annually since NAFTA went into effect in 1993. Trade is vitally important to farmers in New York. We need markets to sell our products, and if NAFTA fails, you know, our farm economy will take a serious blow, especially when, you know, net farm income is really at an all-time low for farmers in New York State in the past several years.
The Farm Advocacy Group issued its state legislative priorities in late January, focusing on issues surrounding economic and income losses. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Pat Bradley.
A month into the legislative session, it's a busy time for state lawmakers in Albany. Budget hearings continue ahead of the April 1st deadline, and City of Albany leaders were once again asking for $12.5 million in state aid. 109th District Assembly Democrat Pat Fahey spoke with the Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas about three pressing issues.
Let's just start with net neutrality. I think I was turned on to that one or educated on that one because I have a 21-year-old, because I found there's a real age difference. It seems like the millennials really understand the negative impact of the federal government, in this case, the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, rolling back or abandoning, if you will, the net neutrality principles. So what we are saying is we want to see those principles abided by and not abandoned because, as I was educated from my 21-year-old, those principles are essential for keeping a free and open internet. Well, nothing has fueled job growth in upstate New York more than small businesses and entrepreneurial businesses. And more, the internet is vital to that. So it is important that we not have what we call those fast lanes and slow lanes, because the fast lanes would be this paid prioritization that more large companies could afford, but it would really squeeze out entrepreneurs and small businesses, as well as, by the way, small school districts or libraries or what have you. So he helped to educate me, but then I also have a millennial on staff who said, wow, this is about to be overturned. We knew to jump on it because one of the things I'm forever looking out for is job growth and knowing, having worked at the Labor Department, knowing that small and medium-sized businesses are really the lifeblood of the upstate economy. And yes, we got more national press on the net neutrality bill initially than we did state press because there was a real recognition that we were taking on the feds on this. So I got more press in Washington, D.C. initially than we did here in the state. But since then, thankfully, we introduced this in mid-December. The governor issued an executive order on the almost identical to my bill. He issued that executive order about a week or two ago, and he's going to support the legislation because he recognizes how important it is as well. By the way, it's not just small business, though. Even Netflix, Facebook, companies, the big guns also recognize that we must keep a free and open internet, and we must not abandon the net neutrality principles despite what the FCC is trying to do.
Now, what about DACA and the Dreamers?
DACA, that is not my bill. It is something I am supportive of, and yes, I've been outspoken. I think one of the things in this country that helped build this country is the fact that we are a land of immigrants. Because that lesson is very fresh for me, I'm first generation. My parents came off the boat, literally off the boat in the New York City harbor, came here penniless, and they came here for the same universal goals that virtually every immigrant has come here for. And that is the chance that their children would have an education, an opportunity, an education that they didn't have in their home country, and for job opportunities that they did not have in their country. So I never forget that there, but for the grace of God, go I. Yes, my parents came here legally. Yes, immigration had just opened up after World War II at that time. But with DACA, those are children. They were brought by parents. Some of them came as infants to this country. And I don't think that we should penalize the children, especially so many of these children who are now young adults, We should not penalize them for the actions of the parents, especially since many of them really have no country to go home to.
That's New York State Assemblywoman Pat Fahey of the 109th District speaking with our Dave Lucas. And that about does it for this week's show. We had help from the New York State Public Radio Network. For copies, call 1-800-323-9262. That's 1-800-323-9262. Ask for program number 1807, or just listen or podcast on the web at wamc.org. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina.
Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.